Thank you, Jim. I am Chester E., and I am an alcoholic.
Hi.
I'm glad to be here, and I'm also glad you're here. You know, I always think if this guy's going to make a little talk, it's nice to somebody.
No.
It helps an awful lot. And I am not unmindful of the fact that there's a football game going on right now that a lot of you'd like to be looking at. And so I am most grateful that you've taken the time out to come over here. This is your 11th Michigan State Conference. It's an anniversary. And I think that any anniversary in AA, whether it be individual or group or anniversary of any kind, any one of these occasions is pretty hard to celebrate. Because for any alcoholic to be sober for any length of time, he must have received a miracle. He is the product of a miracle. And how are you going to celebrate a miracle? Certainly, we can take no personal credit for it. And so I think that it's a time for gratitude, remembering from whence this great thing came. Maybe remembering those who worked out this way of life for us. Bill and Dr. Bob and the rest of them. And being most grateful to them and maybe remembering them in our prayer. And maybe taking this time as a time of inventory, personal inventory. Seeing how closely we are practicing these principles in all of our affairs one day at a time. And lastly, making it a period of rededication. Rededication to the and to the principle that will make this wonderful thing possible. Insofar as I am concerned, your 11th anniversary was a success at the end of your first meeting, Friday night. What a terrific start we got in this conference. And insofar as I'm concerned, it has been a success on many occasions in my room up at the hotel. We have had a series of wonderful meetings in there. And for that, I am most grateful. And as the meetings progressed, California was quite well represented. We had Wayne H., and he did a tremendous job here the other afternoon. And we had Anita last night. And all I hope is that I don't mess up what they've done. If I can get down without messing that up, I'll be very happy. I particularly enjoyed yesterday's meeting that took in industry and the judiciary and doctors and psychiatrists and religion. I thought that was a wonderful meeting. And now for the confession. If the committee had taken care of my traveling expenses prior to just 5 minutes ago, I would have left after the spiritual meeting this morning. The only thing that kept me in town is that they held out on me till the last. That was a fabulous meeting. And I'm so happy that I was here. And so now I would be remiss if I didn't thank the committee for thinking of me and making it possible for me to be here with you through this time. You know, if I dislike each of you, and if I didn't like our program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I would still be here. Because I am an alcoholic. I cannot live and drink, and of myself, I can't keep from drinking. And so, if I disliked the whole deal, I would be here, because the ability to live without drinking is synonymous with life to me. But fortunately for me, I love the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I love the people in it. And I love the God, my God, whom I have found in this program. And it is no chore for me to be in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have no difficulty with you people. My problems, when I have any, there's too much on it. If I have to spend too much time away from my own folks, I get too itch. And I have to get back in a meeting real good to get back on the beat. I remember a few years ago I was talking in a hospital to the staff. And the head nurse said to me, isn't it sort of morbid to spend too much time with alcoholics? And you know, I couldn't tell her. I couldn't tell her. So I'm real glad to be here. I said I'm an alcoholic. I'm neither proud of it nor am I ashamed of it. That's the way it is with me. I am an alcoholic. I think that it's a wonderful thing when at long last we can accept ourselves exactly as we are and go from there. Now, something has to happen to people like me before they can say I am an alcoholic. If 40 years ago, any one of you had called me an alcoholic, and I could have gotten up off the floor, I would have hit you right smack in the nose if I could have seen you. That was something that nobody must know. That's something that I went to any length to keep anybody from knowing, including myself. And so, something had to happen in order that I might be able to get up and say I'm an alcoholic. And it did. Something happened. You know, I'm one of the most fortunate people at Alcoholics Anonymous. I would like to be able to get up here and tell you that I diagnosed my own case and that I saw where I was losing the battle of life and that I figured out that it was about time for me to come to AA. It'd be nice if I could tell you that. But I didn't tell you that. As long as I had choice, I could not come here. You see, I didn't like the good people of the human race in those days. And the drunks I hated. Because I was a drunk, and I hated me, and I hated all of you. And the very idea of me coming to a bunch of drunks for help was absolutely obnoxious to me. And I could not come here until I'd run out of choice. But that time came. I not only ran out of choice, I ran out of everything else. I ran out of people. Family. And health. And sanity. And money. And liquor. All at the same time. And when there was nothing left to do, and no place else to go, I came here. And so I am most fortunate. I am most fortunate also in that I came to the program totally surrendered. I wish I could tell you that I surrendered. That I got enough and threw in the towel, but I didn't. I almost blessed the bottle because the bottle finally surrendered me. It finally beat me into total and complete and absolute nothingness. And when that happened, I surrendered. You know, it's funny how easy it is to surrender when you ain't got nothing to give up. And I came to the program in a state of total surrender. And I'm most fortunate in this, because everything that I heard, and everything that I saw, and everything that was read, was something I wanted to do. And it's been my good fortune to live for something over 6,470 days without the necessity to take a drink of liquor or a sedating or tranquilizing pill of any kind. Now, lest some of you who are not so apt at mathematics get lost in figures and miss my profound talk. That is something over 17 years and 8 months without a drink or a sedating or tranquilizing pill. And so I'm very fortunate indeed. I've heard a few references made during this conference to the honeymoon in A and to the pink cloud experience. And I'm one who believes that the honeymoon should never become less sweet, nor should the pink cloud turn gray. There is nothing in my book, and there is nothing in my AA experience that indicates that the honeymoon should turn sour and that the pink cloud should get less pink. I think that the honeymoon should become sweeter and the pink cloud pinker with every day that we walk in this way. For 17 years and 8 months, my life has become continuously better. And I never had it so good as right now. Neither have I ever been so dependent as I am right now. I am totally dependent today. Totally dependent. Totally dependent on you, the peoples of AA, and on our program, and on my God. I can't run my life. I can't run yours. I can't run my wife or my kids. I can't run my business. This I know. I can't live and drink, and I can't keep from drinking. So what can I do? I can practice these principles in all of my affairs one day at a time. I can share my experience, strength, and hope such as it is with anybody that wants it. And that's all I can do, and that's my business. And that's what I do. And it seems to be enough. Now, my dependency isn't a dependency of fear. I haven't been afraid since I woke up to the fact that I was sober. 6 months after I got the book, I attended meetings every night for 6 months with a great fear upon me that I couldn't have this thing. I didn't think I had enough body and mind left to get it. And yet I had seen and felt something that I wanted more than life itself. And so every night of the week I was back in a meeting with this great fear upon me that it couldn't happen. And after 6 months I woke up to the fact that it was sober and had been from the very first meeting. And since this awakening, I've never been afraid. I haven't been afraid of alcohol. I haven't been afraid of you. I haven't been afraid of me. I haven't been afraid of life or death, or things present or things to come. So it isn't a dependency of fear, it's a dependency of certainty. a dependency of certainty. Three things I know. And that's all I know. And I'm getting along in years, you know. I only know three things. Number one, that I'm an alcoholic. I can't run my own life. How do I know that? Because I spent 10 of the last years of my drinking trying to prove it wasn't true. And I proved it was. So I know I'm an alcoholic and can't run my own life. That probably no human power could have relieved my alcoholism. How do I know this? Because I went to human power before I got here. The men of the cloth, the doctors of medicine, and the people who know more of psychiatry than there is. And I didn't find an answer. That no human power could have relieved my alcoholism, this I know. And that God can and will if I work with Him. Now, I don't know this, because for 17 years and 8 months I haven't had a drink. So this is my certainty, you see. It's my business to walk in this way. This is my business. And it's God's business to take care of me. Of this I am totally certain, because infinitely more good has come into my life in 17 years and 8 months than in the entire previous 43. And I didn't bring it about. Now, one of the good things about coming to the program, as I did, you see, I didn't even want sobriety for myself because my life was over. Everything dear to me in life was gone, and I knew that it should be gone and that I wasn't entitled to have it back. So I didn't even want sobriety for myself. I just wanted to be sober until I died. Because I didn't want to die with the record. I wanted to use whatever time I had, which I knew was going to be very short. I had almost died the next to the last time out. And so I knew that I wasn't going to live very long. But such time as I had, I wanted to use it rubbing out the record. I didn't want to die with those kids and their mother and those who had been close to me. Remembering me as nothing but a tongue-chewing, babbling, idiot drunk. And so, I came for only one thing. Having accepted the fact that everything dear to me was gone, and that I wasn't entitled to have it back, I came for only one thing, hoping against hope, that I might find a way that I could live until I kicked off without that flit, without having to drink that stuff. And I would have settled for the meanest old unhappy sobriety on the face of the earth, just as long as it didn't include alcohol. I didn't have a sponsor. I never talked to anybody about this program. And so I didn't know that maybe if I came here and got sober, I'd get my family back. And I'd get my job back, and I'd get my health back. And that good things would happen in my life. I didn't know this. I came merely for sobriety. And I was really taken in real fast, because when I got to the meeting, I went alone. I was as alone as any man could possibly be. And I hadn't been briefed. And I got to the meeting before it started. And there were about 35 or 40 people there. And they were all talking, you know. Every one of them talking and nobody listening. Just like it always is. I often wonder how in the world we ever learn anything when everybody talks and nobody listens. But we do. And I stopped at the doorway and looked you over. And you didn't look like me. And you weren't dressed like me. And you most certainly didn't feel like me. And you didn't talk like me. Because that was all happy talk. And I said to myself, I've been given the wrong dope. This is the wrong night. These are the veterans and their wives, and they're here for a party. Because it was in the Veterans of Foreign Wars Hall. And I said to myself, I'm going to have to leave and come back the night the drunks are here. And if you ever saw a guy that was down, I was down. Here I had finally come to a meeting, and I'd gotten the wrong night. And I left, and my heart was dragging 10 feet behind me. Started to leave, and somebody had been looking for me, looking at me, noticed me. And he came hurrying over to the door. And he says, Mister, were you looking for somebody? And I said, no, sir. And he says, what were you looking for? And thinking he was a veteran, I said, well, sir, if it would interest you, I was looking for sobriety. And he lit up like a church. His whole being changed right there in front of my eyes. And I was hooked before he ever opened his mouth. Here was a guy that was obviously glad, clear through, that I was there. Well, now everybody that knew me was glad I was there too, but for a different reason. They were glad I was there because being there, I couldn't be there, you see. But here was a guy that had his whole being had changed. And he said to me, why, take off your hat and coat. You're in the right place. And they shared their experience, strength, and hope with me. The strength. And I decided that night I wanted what you had. And became willing to go to any length to get it. And I've never had to have a drink from that night to this. Now I'm one who believes that the doctors are right in their definition of our disease. I have an allergy of the body and an obsession of the mind. I know this. My body cannot successfully handle alcohol, and I know it. And I know further that of myself I can't keep from drinking. So I go along with the obsession of the mind and the allergy of the body. But I think there's something else to this thing. I think there are three parts to it. The disease of alcoholism. I think there are three parts to it. I think there's the obsession of the mind and the allergy of the body, but there is also the sickness of the soul. The sickness of the soul, which I suspect is prior to and maybe father to the obsessions of the mind and the allergy of the body. Now, most of you people who are at this conference have been around a while, and we know the kind of peoples we are. And we might talk with each other a little bit about the kind of peoples we are. And you know, the longer I'm in this fellowship, the more I think of the non-alcoholic world. I've come to pretty near like them already. Because we didn't show them a very pretty picture. The more I'm around here, the more grateful I am that they didn't shoot us all before we even got here. Well, now, what kind of people are we? Some fellow read statistics yesterday that said a recovering alcoholic was a 17% more efficient workman in any field than the average non-alcoholic. Now, I agree with that wholeheartedly, but I think the percentage was a little low. But we are a sort of a capable bunch, and we know our own capabilities a long time before we lose the battle. And we are a complex of paradoxes, we are this. A complex of paradoxes. For instance, it's not strange to us that many of us have cried our eyes out over a beautiful sunset when we were so drunk we couldn't even get up off the floor. It's just a pity we can't stand it, you know? And there we lay, bawling our eyes out. Well, now how are you going to explain this to the so-called normal world? We understand it, but they don't. My wife used to say to me, "Chuck, if you loved me, you wouldn't do these things." Now, how in the hell could I tell her it was because I loved her that I did it? And yet some of the worst drugs I ever went on was because I knew I was crucifying my own wife and our children. And I couldn't stand it because I loved them. And I didn't want to crucify them, but the hurt was so great that I had to get drunk all over again and crucify them all over again. These things are hard to explain. An alcoholic don't like dirt. And how dirty can you get? Don't answer that because I know. One of my greatest memories is coming off a lousy little old 30-day drunk, something like that. And as soon as I could walk, I headed for the shower. And I get in the shower and wear out two cakes of soap trying to get clean. We don't like dirt. Now, of course, before we learned that it was an inside job, you see. And so we'd get all scrubbed up, and then we'd get to the barber shop and get our ears set out, get the beard scraped off our face, and then get the best duds we got on our backs. We don't like dirt. But how are you going to explain the fact that there you lay in the gutter, and the pig got up and slowly walked away? A complex of paradoxes. An alcoholic don't like weakness. We hate weakness. We hate weakness in everybody, and much more so in ourselves. But how weak can you get? Don't answer that, because I also know the answer to that one. And thinking that weakness and surrender are synonymous, we cannot surrender. We simply can't. The strong man wins his battle, says we. The weak man surrenders. And we keep fighting a losing battle for 10 years after we lost it. And we cannot surrender. And yet surrender is the very first qualification for sobriety, if we be alcoholics. Surrender is the first condition. Would to God it were possible for one of us to tell another what it means to surrender. I would rather be able to tell one audience what it means to surrender than to be president of the universe. But it cannot be done. It cannot be done. The only thing we can say about it is that for the alcoholic, surrender is victory. In my own life, I believe it to be the greatest single experience between the cradle and the grave. I believe that it's impossible to live in freedom and in peace and in joy without it. Don't be afraid of it. Surrender is victory for the alcoholic. And as I told you in the beginning, I am so fortunate because I came to the program surrendered. I had abandoned myself not to this simple program and not to God, but I had abandoned myself to nothing, which in my own thinking is the same thing. And if I don't forget it, I'll try to explain that before I sit down. Likely won't. And so, as I said, everything about this program was something I wanted to do, and something I have done. And so many people come to me and they say, "But Chuck, how do you surrender? How do you surrender?" And that's a good question. Well, my answer is this. If we come to the program not surrendered, the first 9 steps in the program, if we will take them as honestly as we know how, will surrender us. The first 9 steps of the program are designed to squeeze us out of ourselves. And they will do it if we do it But they won't do it if we don't. You know, the last line before these steps is most meaningful. It says here are the steps we took. Here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. It doesn't say here are the steps we read. It doesn't say here are the steps we learned by heart. It doesn't say here are the steps we talked about a little in last night's discussion meeting. It says here are the steps we took. And this is most meaningful. If we take them, something happens. And if we don't take them, nothing happens. So let's remember that. And the first 9 of them will surrender anybody that'll do them. Now, they do other things too, but let's look at them for just a moment. You see, I haven't talked about anything for 17 years and 8 months but surrender. This is the only thing I talk about. And that's the reason we're going on this beam again today. The alcoholic, looking at the first step, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. This is a twofold admission of defeat. Powerless over alcohol, physical. Unmanageable lives, mental. We admitted that we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Now, for an alcoholic, this is quite a thing. Who's going to admit that they're powerless over anything? And who's going to admit that they can't run their own lives? So the squeeze plays on right in the very first step, you see. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Now I'd like to stop just a second and remind all of us that that doesn't say that our lives had become unmanageable whilst drunk. Many of us read it and think about it. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable while drunk. And we keep it for maybe a few years while drunk, retaining the idea that we're pretty cute operators when we're sober. That doesn't say while drunk. It says, unmanageable lives, period. And I'll tell you something. There's nothing in the book that says after 17 years and 8 months, I'll be able to run my life again, either. I have looked, and it ain't better. So the squeeze plays on. And number 2 says, we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Now there's an implication here. There's no sense in restoring a sane man to sanity, is there? This is a backwards admission that we're nuts. Insane. And incidentally, that doesn't say insanity whilst drunk. The book isn't talking about insanity whilst drunk. It's talking about insanity whilst not drunk, whilst sober. Non-alcoholics do insane things when they're drunk, you know. So it isn't insanity while drunk. It's the insanity that will allow a guy like me that I was just going about to tell you I was a genius. But I don't need to. You know that. I'm an alcoholic. That will allow a smart guy like me to look at a 25-year record. That includes everything. And come up with a profound conclusion. This time it's going to be different. That's insanity that we've got to get rid of. So in number one, we admit that we've lost the battle. In number two, we admit we're nuts. And the squeeze blows on. And the next one is worse than those two put together. Because here we got to get a new driver. We made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God. New driver. Which one of you ever gave up the wheel? When they argued with you about who's going to drive home, who lost? I had to drive, I couldn't walk. And so we admit defeat, we admit we're nuts, and we got to get a new driver. In the first three, and the squeeze plays on. And the fourth is worse than all three of them. It says we made a fearless and thorough moral inventory of ourselves. Now, if you think that's an ego builder, get your pencil and start writing. We stop and take a look at ourselves without any excuses. And the squeeze play is on for in earnest. And number five is worse than all four of them. Because number five says we admit it to God, to ourselves, and to another human being, the exact nature of our wrongs. Now I can take the first two halves of it under that table, or the first two thirds of the step. I can hide under that table and take two of them. And nobody knows but me and God. But it don't stop there. It says, and another human being. Here I've got to get all this dirty linen together and spread it out before another human being. And brethren and sister, if you got any ego after that one, you ain't done it. That's a king-sized ego buster. And the next one says we were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. There's not much ego left here. We're getting cut down to size now. We're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. And seven, humbly ask him to remove our shortcomings. And I'd like to stop here just a second. You know, in our part of the country, so many keep bringing these defects of character back and working on them. They seem to make a lifetime job out of pulling these defects of character back and beating themselves to death with them. I don't read my book like that. If I'd have had to work on my defects of character one at a time, I would have died drunk 17 years ago. This says we make our inventory, that we become entirely willing to give them away, and that we give them away. And how do we know if we give them away? If we haven't got them. We humbly ask God to remove all these defects of character. I don't think it's necessary for us to do these things over and over and over again. I think it's necessary for us to continue to take daily inventory, and we'll get to that in a minute. But not to go back and keep bringing up the past. I have the feeling that anybody that takes number 5 twice is bragging. Humbly ask him to remove our shortcomings. And the next two are fabulous steps. Don't sell these too short. To do these is like an inside shower. Just like an inside shower. We made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. And we made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. Don't sell these short. They are at once about the most difficult and about the most rewarding steps in the whole program. It is here that we get rid of 99% almost of the burden we're carrying around. That we go to our people and say, look, I'm not the big shot that I would have had you believe. I'm an alcoholic. And I found a program that might make it possible for me to live the rest of my life out one day at a time without drinking. And one of its conditions is that we make amends, and that's exactly why I'm here. I've done you wrong. And I'm not only here to apologize, but I'm here to tell you I am willing to make restitution, and I will do so the very minute that it's possible. Ah, this is a great thing, that we get rid of that load, that burden that we're carrying around. Don't sell these short. Again, it's like an inside shower. And these are the first 9 steps of our program. And if we have done them as honestly as we know how, we have been automatically squeezed out of ourselves. And we're ready then for the last. We stay level. We stay surrendered by continuing to take our own inventories and promptly admitting our wrongs. You know, a couple of little things that have been so good for me in this program. 20 years ago, I could not say I don't know. It was impossible for me to say I don't know. You could have asked me anything and I would have told you. If you would have asked me how God created the universe, I would have told you. And I would have probably have told you that now on the third day we did thus and so. I couldn't say I don't know. But that's the easiest thing in the world for me to say I don't know. It's just so easy. When I don't know, I don't know. When I just tell you I don't know. And it's that simple. And it's an easy way to live. And the next thing was, I'm wrong. I can tell you that. If I was dead wrong and caught red-handed, I had an alibi. It wasn't my fault. It wasn't even my fault that I drank. It was yours. And my mother-in-law. But now it's so easy for me to say I'm wrong. I thought I was right, but I was dead wrong. And I'm sorry. We continued to take daily inventory. And the last two then, the first nine surrenders, the tenth keeps us surrendered, if we do them. And the last two bring us into the AA way of life, than which there is nothing finer under heaven. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious awareness of the living presence the Almighty. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him. Now I deliberately left that out of the third step, because in my opinion this has nothing to do with understanding the infinite. If it had been a condition for sobriety that I understand the infinite, I would have died drunk. In my own opinion, this has nothing to do with understanding the infinite. It has only to do with the necessity of individual experience. My God, your God. The necessity of individual experience. I tried to find your God for 35 years before I got here. And I couldn't find him. And I came here not even looking for my own, and did these things. And my God found me, or we found each other, or something. I woke up to the fact that it had happened. That which I had hunted for all my life had happened. And so it is the necessity of individual experience, my God, your God. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with our own God. Praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. I've come to think that this is just about the only prayer we need. Oh, I do it a little different when I drive out of my little city. Going to my office, I drive up through Laguna Canyon. And if you were following me, you might think that I was a little nuts, because you wouldn't see anybody in there but me. But I'd probably be talking and laughing. You know? And you wouldn't see anybody. You say the boy hasn't got his marbles back. The second step hasn't done well by him yet. But I might be doing something like this. I might be saying, look, Father, I'm reporting for duty. Now I'm going to move it around. I'm going to do the best I can with what I got today. And all I want out of you is a little guidance and direction and the power to carry it out. Sure, thank you. Or I might be saying, look at me, Dad. Look what I did yesterday. Isn't this lousy for a guy like me? What do you think of a guy that knows what I do, doing a thing like that? I don't like it. And you don't like it. And I'm going to try to do better. And with your help, I'll do a lot better. Sure, thank you. Seeking only for knowledge of his will for me and the power to carry it out. This is a fabulous, fabulous thing. I can't run my life. I can't run yours. I can't run anything. But my life has run pretty good for a long time. And I want to share a little experience with you. Sometime back, Mrs. C and I were going up to Santa Cruz to talk. It was on a Saturday night. And at noon, the local folks took us out into that beautiful big redwood grove at Santa Cruz. And they were showing us these big trees. Now, 20 years ago, I had been through these big trees, but I knew all about them. I knew a big tree when I saw it, you know. But this time, I didn't know quite as much. And they'd given me a paper to read, and I was reading. I can read now, too. And I was reading about what we were looking at. And the first thing that really knocked me off of the Christmas tree, we came to what they called the sister trees. And here were two great giant redwoods that had grown up pretty close together. And up yonder someplace they crossed each other. And I reckon the wind and all that blew them around, it annoyed them. And so what did they do? They had grown a natural graft between them to separate them. A natural graft growing from one tree to the other. And I stood there and I looked at this and I thought to myself, why is it so difficult for you and for me, God's children, to come to depend on this great power, our Father? Even as the redwood, in the very idea of a redwood tree, everything was included for its fulfillment, even to a natural graft. Why can't we see this? Why can't we see that it's normal and natural that we depend on guidance and direction and the power to carry it out? We supposedly God's crowning creation. And we went on through looking at this and that. And just before we finished our little tour, we came to a tree that had been burned out. 150 years ago, the base of this tree had been burned out. And up 50 feet above the ground, two limbs had grown out of that tree and grown down and grown into that wound and healed the burn. Now, this isn't natural. It's not normal for limbs to grow out and down and into the tree. But you could stand there and look at it. And I stood there and looked, and I cried like a baby. If God in His infinite wisdom can so take care of a redwood tree, what can He do for His children if we'll work with Him? Fabulous. Now, I got to tell you a little sequel to this, and it's not easy. There was a man in our country who didn't like me, who had made it his business to stay away from meetings where I talked. And if he got tricked, he got up and left when he found that I was to be there. And his name was Johnny. And Johnny had had an awful tough time with the spiritual side of the program. And somehow he got trapped in a meeting and couldn't get out. And I told this little story. And it was his key. And he found himself and his God. And he was an outdoor man, and the story had been very meaningful to him. And a couple of years later, he had gotten a pigeon who also was an outdoor man and who was having a rough time getting the feel of this thing. And so Johnny had taken him out in the country, and they'd gotten out of the car and were walking about. And Johnny told him this little story that I've just related. And as he told it, he says, and Chuck looked up there, and the trees had formed a natural graph. And his man followed his point of vision. And he says, why, Johnny, you're pointing at the same thing. And there, right in front of the point, was a natural graph. And they came back to town. And they got their camera and went back and took a picture of it. And honored me at a meeting and showed me this. This couldn't have happened once in a million times. How fortunate are we that at the time of our need, something or somebody fulfills it in this great program of ours. This is the dependency I was talking about a while ago. The dependency of certainty. And lastly, step 12. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. Now again, this doesn't say maybe. This says having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. Not these steps and something else. These steps. And there's an implication here. When you and I fulfill these first 11 steps to the best of our ability, one day at a time, the spiritual awakening is a certainty, not a maybe, a certainty. It's the natural result of the doing of these other things. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all of our affairs. Now, in the attempt to carry this message, we learn something else that is of infinite value. In the very doing of these things, we learn that this has never been a getting life. It has forever been a giving life. And the more we pour out without a price tag on it, the more we have. And we just learn it by the doing. We try to share this thing. We try to give it away. And in the doing, we learn what St. Francis meant when he said, because it is in giving that we receive. And we never know till we do. Now, how do I know this? Because for 43 years of my life, I lived to get. To get the things I thought I was born without. To get the things that I thought I must have, I had been conditioned to believe I must have them in order to live. And I wasn't a fast buck artist. I worked hard. And I never tried to jip anybody. I tried to give a good day's work. But it was to get. And I ended up at the ripe old age of 43, a total failure in every department of life. And for 17 years and 8 months, I've lived to try to add a little in every situation I find myself. And infinitely more good has come into my life than in the entire previous 43. And so we come to see the wisdom in the words, fear not, little flock. It's the Father's good pleasure to give us the kingdom. It's the Father's good pleasure to give us the kingdom. And we learn it only by the doing. And lastly, and practice these principles in all of our affairs. Now this means that we take all the division out of life. And nothing is more or less spiritual, and nothing is more or less valuable, and nothing is more or less important than another. Because when we practice these principles in all of our affairs, it's all the same. And we're not a house divided against itself anymore. We are made whole. And we come to see that life is for the living. There's nothing but life but the living thereof right now. The only reason for it is the joy of it. Not for my glory, but for the glory of the Father, in whom I live and move and have my being. And we learn this just by the doing. Just by the doing. It puts us back together. We are made whole. How fortunate can a man be? How fortunate can a man be? I came here for one thing. Oh, I had all the problems that a man can accumulate in 25 years of drinking. My good wife was divorcing me. Our kids wouldn't even come home when I was around if they could help. The boss had sent word that if I ever set foot in the plant again, he was going to throw me through the window. And the window to which he referred don't open. So I had all the problems you can get. But I came here for one thing, and one thing only. Hoping against hope that I might find a way to live without drinking. And all of these things have been added. And when I look at the life that was mine 20 years ago, the life that was my wife and our children and my family, and when I look at it today, I can't believe it. How fortunate can a man be that he be returned from the land of the living dead into a life like this? And I'm so grateful I can't see. I'm so grateful I can't see. I haven't words to tell you my gratitude, because you see, I didn't do this. I didn't do this. This for the grace of God through the miracle of AA. And I want to close by telling you what I think it is, and you can all disagree with me if you want to. I don't care. But in these past several years, I don't read much anymore. 35 years, I read everything of a religious and philosophical nature that I get my hands on. But now I sit up there in my window. We're so fortunate. We sit up, our home is about 500 feet above the ocean. Laguna Beach, and we look down on the little town. And on that beautiful coastline, and on the islands, and the ocean, and the heavens. Everything that God ever created right out in my window. And I like to sit there and look at the miracle of AA, and try to read it. Try to read life. And it's the finest book I ever tried to read. And so this then seems to me to be the problem and the answer. You see, alcoholism is a living problem. And you and I must have a living answer, a total living problem. And we must have a total living answer, because we can't settle for less. By our very nature, we can't settle for less. And if there's one thing that has become increasingly apparent to me, it is that the first two words of the little prayer we're about to say together mean exactly what they say. Our Father. Our Father. And if God is our Father, we are His children. It has to be. If God is our Father, we are His children. And I am one who believes that God has always known this. But you and I individually have to find it out. We have to find this out for ourselves. We can't be told. We have to find it out. And so, people say so often, but Chuck, if there is a loving God, how come He let you burn for 10 years in hell? This couldn't be. And I say, yes, it can be. God loves me enough to allow me to make my own mistakes, that I might the sooner run out of my own resources and come back home. And come back home where I belong. Now there was a chap many years ago, his name was Brother Lawrence. And he said, if you would find God, look deep within yourself, because it's the only place you're ever going to find. And how is a monkey like me going to look deeper than myself? I've got some windows to wash first. I've got some wreckage of the past to clear up first. I got to dig out. And how do I do it? By the application of these 12 steps to my very own life. In the surrender, I'm temporarily rid of the ego. And without the ego, I don't need its children. And what are its children? Self-pity, resentment, judgment, lies, deceits, hate. All these things we peel off like peeling a banana. In the application of these principles to our very own life. And pretty soon the overburden is gone. And we can look deep within ourselves and find ourselves and each other and our very own God. And so I don't believe this is something added, some special dispensation or special grant, but it is something uncovered. Fear not, little flock, it's the Father's good pleasure to give us the kingdom, but not on our terms, on His. And His terms are so simple that the world can't see. His terms are simply that we act like His children. That we go about our Father's business. That we share our experience, strength, and hope one with another in love. These are His terms. And when we fulfill the conditions, lo and behold, we come into our inheritance. Ah, how fortunate can we be? How precious is this society to me? And how I love the likes of you, because you helped me weed my garden. You help me not only to find myself, but to find you and to find our Father. And what a thing it is. Don't be afraid of this program. Don't think that you're better to hold out a little. Give yourself to it completely. It is the most fascinating, the most fabulous, the most rewarding living experience that anybody could ever get to teach in. And it gets better for at least 17 years and 8 months. It's been a joy to be with you. And I would leave you with this little prayer that so many people sent me last Christmas. So simple, and I love it so much. And this is my prayer for you and for me. It's an old Gaelic thing that goes like this. May your roads rise with you. May the wind be always at your back. May the good Lord hold you in the hollow of his hand. God bless you all. Thank you.